Don't waste my time, or yours, thinking about who you were before I knew you." Lart showed Homer a letter he was writing. It was still in the typewriter. It was a letter to someone at the New England Home for Little Wanderers, which had been an orphanage even longer than St. Cloud's. The letter was friendly and familiar. Larch's correspondent appeared to be an old colleague, if not an old friend. There was in the tone of Larch's argument, too, the sparkle of frequent debate, as if the correspondent were someone Larch had often used as a kind of philosophical opponent. The reasons orphans should be adopted before adolescence is that they should be loved and have someone to love before they embark on that necessary phase of adolescence, namely, deceitfulness, Larch argued in the letter. A teenager discovers that deceit is almost as seductive as sex, and much more easily accomplished. It may be especially easy to deceive loved ones. The people who love you are the least willing to acknowledge your deceit. But if you love no one and feel that no one loves you, then there's no one with the power to sting you by pointing out to you that you're lying. If an orphan is not adopted by the time he reaches this alarming period of adolescence, he may continue to deceive himself and others forever. For a terrible time of life, a teenager deceives himself. He believes he can trick the world. He believes he is invulnerable. An adolescent who is an orphan at this phase is in danger of never growing up. Of course, Dr. Larch knew Homer Wells was different. He was loved by Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna and by Dr. Larch, in spite of himself. And Homer Wells not only knew that he was loved, he also probably knew that he loved these people. His age of deceit might be blessedly brief. Melanie was the perfect example of the adolescent orphan Larch described in his letter to the New England Home for Little Wanderers. This also occurred to Homer Wells, who had asked Melanie, before he gave her the note that her history was not to be found, what she wanted to find her mother for. "To kill her," Melanie had said without hesitation. "Maybe I'll poison her. But if she's not as big as I am, if I'm much stronger than she is, and I probably am, then I'd like to strangle her." "To strangle her," repeated Homer Wells uncontrollably. "Why?" Melanie asked him. "What would you do if you found your mother?"
"I don't know," he said. "Ask her some questions, maybe."
"Ask her some questions?" Melanie said. Homer had not heard such scorn in Melanie's voice since her response to Jane Eyre's Gleams of Sunshine. Homer knew that his simple note, "not to be found," would never satisfy her, although Homer had found Dr. Larch, as usual, to be convincing. Homer was also holding back. He was still deceiving Dr. Larch and himself a little. The photograph of the woman with the pony was still pinned between his mattress and his bed springs. It had grown almost soft with handling. Frankly, Homer was full of regret. He knew he could not produce Melanie's history, and that without it he would be denied the pony's seemingly singular experience.
"What does he mean, not to be found?" Melanie screamed at Homer.
They were on the sagging porch of the building where the woman and the pony had spent so many years.
"What he means is he's playing God. He gives you your history or he takes it away. If that's not playing God, what is?"
Homer Wells let this pass. Dr. Larch, Homer knew, played God in other ways. It was still Homer's cautious opinion that Dr. Larch played God pretty well. "Here in St. Cloud's," Dr. Larch wrote, "I have been given the choice of playing God or leaving practically everything up to chance. It is my experience that practically everything is left up to chance much of the time. Men who believe in good and evil, and who believe that good should win, should watch for those moments when it is possible to play God. We should seize those moments. There won't be many. Here in St. Cloud's, there may be more moments to seize than one could find in the rest of the world, but that is only because so much that comes this way has been left to chance already."
"God damn him!" Melanie screamed.
But the river was ever loud. The empty building had heard much worse than this in its day. And Homer Wells let this remark pass, too.
"Too bad for you, sunshine," Melanie snapped at him. "Isn't it?" she insisted.
He kept his distance.
"So," she yelled,
of which the main woods across the river managed only a short echo of the O. She lifted her heavy leg and kicked a whole section of the wrecked porch rail into the river.
"So this is it!"
Melanie cried. But the forest was too dense to manage even a clipped echo of the it. The main woods, like Homer Wells, let Melanie's remark pass.
"Jesus!" Melanie cried.
But the forest repeated nothing. The old building might have creaked. Possibly it sighed. It was difficult to destroy that building. Time and other vandals had already destroyed it. Melanie was looking for possible parts of the building she could still destroy. Homer followed her at a safe distance.
"Sunshine,"
Melanie said, finding a small pane of glass that hadn't been smashed, and smashing it.
"Sunshine, we've got nobody. If you tell me we've got each other, I'll kill you."
It had not occurred to Homer to offer this or any other suggestion to Melanie. He kept silent.
"If you tell me we've got your favorite Dr. Larch or this whole place," she said, stamping her foot through a floorboard, trying to pry the floorboard loose with both hands, "if you tell me that, I'll torture you before I kill you."
"Right," said Homer Wells. With the floorboard in both hands, Melanie attacked the banister of the main staircase. The banister was knocked apart easily, but the banister post, which anchored the whole railing in the downstairs hall, remained upright. Melanie dropped the floorboard and seized the banister post in a bear hug.
"God damn you!" she screamed,
at Dr. Larch, at her mother, at St. Cloud's, at the world. She wrestled the post to the floor. It was still attached to a main support beam under the floorboards, but Melanie swung a piece of the banister railing like a club until she was able to knock the post free. When she tried to lift the post and couldn't, she turned to Homer Wells.
"Can't you see I need help?"
she said to him. Together they lifted the post. Using it as a battering ram, they knocked down the kitchen wall.
"Why aren't you angry?" she asked Homer. "What's wrong with you? You're never going to find out who did this to you. Don't you care?"
"I don't know," said Homer Wells. Together, they ran the post head-on into what appeared to be a fairly major beam. Maybe it supports the second floor, thought Homer Wells. They hit the beam 3 blows, bouncing off in a different direction each time. With a 4th try, they cracked it. Something in the building above them appeared to shift. Melanie dropped her share of the banister post and bear-hugged the cracked beam. She tried to run with the beam, her momentum carrying her over the door sill out onto the porch. One of the upstairs bunk rooms fell downstairs into the kitchen. When that happened, the porch roof partially collapsed, and what remained of the porch railing was launched into the river. Even Melanie seemed impressed with this much destruction. She took Homer Wells by the hand and almost gently led him upstairs. More than half the upstairs was still upstairs, including the bunk room where the pony and the woman had entertained a former woodsman of St. Cloud's.
"Help me," Melanie said softly to Homer Wells.
They went to the window and together managed to wrest the shutter free of the one hinge that held it. They watched it fall straight through the porch roof and pass even more easily through the porch floorboards before it splashed in the river.
"Neat, huh?"
Melanie asked dully. She sat on the mattress where they'd been kneeling when the snake hit the roof.
"Help me," Melanie said again.
She indicated to Homer that he should sit beside her.
"Help me, or I'm going to run away," she told him. "Help me, or I'm going to kill someone."
These notions seemed vaguely parallel, if not equal, to her. Homer realized that it was not easy for him, in the case of Melanie, to be of use, but he tried.
"Don't kill anyone," he said.
"Don't run away."
"Why stay?" she countered. "You're not staying. I don't mean you'll run away. I mean someone will adopt you."
"No, they won't," Homer said. "Besides, I wouldn't go."
"You'll go," Melanie said.
"I won't," Homer said. "Please, don't run away. Please don't kill anyone."
"If I stay, you'll stay? Is that what you're saying?"
Melanie asked him. "Is that what I mean?" thought Homer Wells. But Melanie, as usual, gave him no time to think.
"Promise me you'll stay as long as I stay, sunshine,"
Melanie said.
She moved closer to him. She took his hand and opened his fingers and put his index finger in her mouth. "Lucky pony," Melanie whispered. But Homer Wells wasn't sure if the pony had been so lucky. The old building gave a groan. Melanie slid his index finger in and out of her mouth. "Promise me you'll stay as long as I stay, sunshine," she said. "Right," said Homer Wells. She bit him. "I promise," Homer said. More of the upstairs fell into the kitchen. There was a sympathetic shriek from the twisted beams that still supported what was left of the porch roof. What was it that distracted him when Melanie finally found his tiny penis and put it into her mouth? He was not afraid that the old building would collapse and kill them both. This would have been a reasonable fear. He was not thinking about the history of the mattress they were lying on. Its history was violent, even by Melanie's standards. He was not thinking of his own lost history, and he wasn't thinking that his being with Melanie was or wasn't a betrayal of Dr. Larch. In part, the noise distracted Homer. There was the noise that Melanie made with her mouth and her breathing, and then there was his own breathing. The racket of this passion reminded him of Little Fuzzy Stone and the energy of those mechanisms that struggled to keep Fuzzy alive. That such wet, breathy effort was made in Fuzzy's behalf seemed to emphasize how fragile his life was. Homer grew only a little bigger in Melanie's mouth. When he started to grow smaller, Melanie increased her efforts. Homer's major distraction was the photograph itself, which he saw very clearly. He could even see the dust-free rectangle on the wall where the photograph had been. If the photograph had at first inspired him to imagine this act with Melanie, now the photograph directly blocked his ability to perform at all. If the woman in the photograph had at first encouraged him to think of Melanie, now the woman and Melanie seemed only abused. The pony's brute insensitivity remained the same, the dumb beast's inappropriate passivity. Homer felt himself grow tinier than he felt he'd ever been. Melanie was humiliated. She shoved him away. "God damn you!" she screamed at him. "What's wrong with you anyway? And don't you tell me there's anything wrong with me." "Right," Homer said. "There isn't." "You bet there isn't," Melanie cried. But her lips looked sore, even bruised, and he saw tears in the anger in her eyes. She yanked the mattress out from under him. Then she folded it in half and threw it out the window. The mattress fell on the roof and stuck half through the hole the shutter had made. This seemed to enrage Melanie, that the mattress hadn't passed cleanly through to the river. She began to dismantle the bunk bed nearest her, crying while she worked. Homer Wells, as he had retreated from her outrage at the gleams of sunshine, retreated from her now. He sneaked down the weakened stairs. When he stepped on the porch, it gave a sharp creak and slumped in the direction of the river, momentarily throwing him off balance. He heard what sounded like several bunk beds, or part of a wall, landing on the roof above him. He fled for open ground. Melanie must have seen him through the upstairs window.
"You promised me, sunshine," she screamed at him. "You promised you wouldn't leave me. As long as I stay, you stay."
"I promise," he called to her. But he turned away and started down the river, along the bank, heading back to the occupied buildings of St. Cloud's and to the orphanage on the hill above the river. He was still on the river bank, near the water's edge, when Melanie managed to dislodge the overhanging porch. The porch roof went with it. He stood and watched what looked like half the building float downstream. Homer imagined that Melanie, given time enough, could possibly rid the landscape of the entire town. But he didn't stay to watch her ongoing efforts at destruction. He went directly to his bed in the sleeping room of the boys' division. He lifted his mattress. He intended to throw the photograph away, but it was gone. "It wasn't me," said Fuzzy Stone. Although it was midday, Fuzzy was still in the sleeping room, imprisoned in his humidified tent. That meant, Homer knew, that Fuzzy was having a kind of relapse. The tent, at night, was Fuzzy's home, but when Fuzzy spent the day in the tent was referred to as his treatment. He had to have what Dr. Larch called tests all the time, too, and every day, everyone knew, he had to have a shot. Homer stood next to the flapping, breathing, gasping contraption, and asked Fuzzy Stone where the photograph was. Homer was informed that John Wilbur had wet his bed so thoroughly that Nurse Angela had told him to lie down on Homer's bed while she replaced the ruined mattress. John Wilbur had found the photograph. He showed it to Fuzzy and a few of the other boys who were around, among them Wilbur Walsh and Snowy Meadows. Snowy had thrown up. "Then what happened?" Homer asked Fuzzy, who was already out of breath. Fuzzy was 9. Next to Homer Wells, he was the oldest orphan in the boys' division. Fuzzy said that Nurse Angela had come back with a fresh mattress for John Wilbur, and she had seen the photograph. Naturally, she'd taken it away. Of course, John Wilbur had told her where he'd found it. By now, Homer knew Nurse Edna would have seen it, and Dr. Larch would have seen it, too. It crossed Homer's mind to go find John Wilbur and hit him, but the boy was too small. He would only pee. There would be this new evidence against Homer.
"But what was it?"
Fuzzy Stone gasped to Homer.
"I thought you saw it," Homer said. "I saw it, but what was it?"
Fuzzy repeated. He looked genuinely frightened. Snowy Meadows had thought that the woman was eating the pony's intestines, Fuzzy explained. Wilbur Walsh had run away. John Wilbur had probably peed some more, thought Homer Wells.
"What were they doing?" Fuzzy Stone pleaded.
"The woman," Fuzzy said with a gasp. "How could she? How could she breathe?"
Fuzzy asked breathlessly. He was wheezing badly when Homer left him. In the daylight, Fuzzy seemed almost transparent, as if he held him up to a bright enough source of light, he could see right through him, see all his frail organs working to save him. Dr. Larch was not in Nurse Angela's office, where Homer had expected to find him. Homer was thankful that Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela were not around. He felt especially ashamed to face them. Outside the hospital entrance, he could see Nurse Angela talking to the man who hauled away the non-burnable trash. The issue of their conversation was John Wilbur's old mattress. Homer went to the dispensary to see if Dr. Larch was there. It had been quite a day for Wilbur Larch, who had reclined on his hospital bed in the dispensary with a gauze cone that was more heavily saturated with ether than was his usual habit. The reported vandalism to the so-called Sawyer's Lodge had upset Larch less than it had disturbed certain townspeople who had witnessed the damage done by Homer and Melanie. Mostly by Melanie, Dr. Larch was sure. What are abandoned buildings for, Dr. Larch wondered, if not for kids to vandalize a little? The report that half the building had floated downriver was surely exaggerated. He inhaled and thought about what had really upset him, that photograph, the woman with the pony. Larch was not bothered that Homer Wells had the picture. Teenagers were interested in that kind of thing. Larch knew that Homer never would have shown it to the younger boys, that Homer had kept such a photograph meant to Wilbur Larch that it was time Homer was given more serious adult responsibilities. It was time to step up the apprenticeship. And the photograph itself, to Larch, was not that upsetting. After all, he had worked in the South End. Such photographs were everywhere. In Wilbur Larch's days at the Boston Lying-In, such pictures cost a dime. What troubled Larch was the particular woman in that photograph. He had no trouble recognizing Mrs. Eames's brave daughter. Larch had seen her cheeks puffed out before. She was a veteran cigar smoker, no stranger to putting terrible things in her mouth. And when she'd been brought to his door with acute peritonitis, the result of whatever unspeakable injuries she had suffered off Harrison, her eyes had bulged then. To look at the photograph reminded Larch of the life she must have had. It reminded him, too, that he could have eased the pain of her life just a little by giving her an abortion. The photograph reminded Larch of a life he could have, if only momentarily, saved. Mrs. Eames's tragic daughter should have been his first abortion patient. Wilbur Larch looked at the photograph and wondered if Mrs. Eames's daughter had been paid enough for posing with the pony to be able to afford the abortion fee off Harrison. Probably not, he concluded. It wasn't even a very good photograph. Whoever had posed the participants had been careless with the young woman's stunning, dark pigtail. It could have been draped over her shoulder, or even been made to lie near her breast.
where its darkness would have accented the whiteness of her skin. It could have been flung straight back behind her head, which at least would have emphasized the pigtail's unusual thickness and length. Obviously, no one had been thinking about the pigtail. It lay off to the side of Mrs. Eames's daughter's face, curled in a shadow that was cast by one of the pony's stout, short, shaggy legs. In the photograph, the pigtail was lost. You had to know Mrs. Eames's daughter to know what that dark shape off to the side of the woman's straining face was.
"I'm sorry," Larch said, inhaling.
Mrs. Eames's daughter did not respond, so he said again, "I'm sorry." He exhaled. He thought he heard her calling him.
"Dr. Larch."
"Rhymes with screams," Wilbur Larch murmured. He took the deepest possible breath. His hand lost touch with the cone, which rolled off his face and under the bed. "Dr. Larch," Homer Wells said again. The smell of ether in the dispensary seemed unusually strong to Homer, who passed through the labyrinth of medicine chests to see if Dr. Larch was on his bed.
"Shit or get off the pot," he heard Dr. Larch say.
Inhale, exhale.
"I'm sorry," Dr. Larch said when he saw Homer beside his bed.
He sat up too fast. He felt very lightheaded. The room was swimming.
"I'm sorry," he repeated.
"That's okay," said Homer Wells. "I'm sorry I woke you up."
"Rhymes with screams," said Wilbur Larch.
"Pardon me," said Homer Wells.
In the closed dispensary, a fragrant mothball sent its vapory messages everywhere.
"Sit down, Homer," said Dr. Larch,
who realized that Homer was already sitting beside him on the bed. Larch wished his head was clearer. He knew this was an important confrontation for the boy. Homer expected to be reprimanded, and not in uncertain terms, but Larch feared he might not be in the best shape for sounding certain.
"Vandalism," Larch launched in. "Pornography."
Now there's a start, he thought, but the boy sitting beside him just waited patiently. Larch took a gulp of what he hoped was clearer air. The fragrance of ether was still heavily present in the dispensary. The air in the immediate vicinity was alternately drowsy and sparkling with little stars.
"Vandalism is one thing, Homer," Larch said, "and pornography, quite another."
"Right," said Homer Wells. "Growing older, learning something new every day."
"More central to our relationship, Homer, is the issue of you deceiving me."
"Right?"
"Right," Homer said.
"Fine," Larch said.
The stars sparkled so brightly on the ceiling of the dispensary that for a moment Dr. Larch thought that their dialogue was taking place under the nighttime firmament. He tipped his head back to escape the fumes, but he lost his balance and fell back on the bed.
"Are you okay?" Homer asked him.
"Fine,"
Larch boomed heartily. Then he started to laugh. It was the first time Homer Wells had heard Dr. Larch laugh.
"Listen, Homer," Dr. Larch said, but he giggled.
"If you're old enough to vandalize whole buildings and masturbate to pictures of women giving blowjobs to ponies, then you're old enough to be my assistant."
This struck Larch as so funny that he doubled up on the bed. Homer thought it was a funny thing to say, too, and he began to smile.
You don't get it, do you?" Larch asked, still giggling. You don't get what I mean."
He lay on his back and waved his feet in the air while the firmament of stars circled above them.
"I'm going to teach you surgery," Larch shouted at Homer, which dissolved both of them into tears of laughter. "Obstetrical procedure, Homer," Larch said.
Homer now fell back on the bed, too.
"The Lord's work and the devil's work, Homer," Larch said, hooting. "The works," he screamed.
Homer started to cough. He was laughing so hard. He was surprised when Larch, like a magician, produced the photograph of the woman and the pony and waved it in front of him.
"If you're old enough even to contemplate this," Larch said,
You're old enough to have a grown-up's job!
This cracked up Larch so completely that he had to hand the photograph to Homer Wells, or else he would have dropped it.
Listen, Homer, Larch said, you're going to finish medical school before you start high school.
This was especially funny to Homer, but Dr. Larch suddenly grew serious. He snatched the photograph back from Homer.
Look at this, he commanded.
They sat on the edge of the bed, and Larch held the photograph steady on his knee.
I'll show you what you don't know.
Look at that, he said, pointing to the pigtail, obscured in the shadow of the pony's leg.
What is it?
He asked Homer Wells.
Teenagers, you think you know everything, Larch said threateningly.
Homer caught the new tone of voice. He paid close attention to this part of the picture he'd never looked at before. A stain on the rug, maybe? Or was it a pool of blood from the woman's ear?
Well? Larch asked. It's not in David Copperfield. It's not in Jane Eyre, either, what you need to know, he added almost nastily.
The medical slant of the conversation convinced Homer Wells that it was a pool of blood in the photograph, that only a doctor could recognize it so positively.
Blood, Homer said. The woman's bleeding.
Larch ran with the photograph to the lamp at the dispensary counter.
Blood? Larch said. Blood?
He looked the photograph all over.
That's not blood, you idiot. That's a pigtail.
He showed the photograph once more to Homer Wells. It would be Homer's last look at the photograph, though Dr. Larch would look at it often. He would keep it attached to the pages of A Brief History of St. Clouds. He did not keep it for pornographic interest, but because it reminded him of a woman he had abused twice. He had slept with her mother in front of her, and he had not provided her with a service that she had every right to request. He had not been a proper doctor to her, and he wanted to remember her. That he was forced to remember her with a pony's penis in her mouth made Dr. Larch's mistakes all the more forcefully mistakes to him. Larch liked it that way. He was a hard man, on himself, too. He took a harder line toward Homer Wells than the hilarity of his promises to the boy at first suggested. To teach him the works, as Larch called it, was not so funny. Surgery, obstetrical procedure, even a normal birth, even the standard D&C, required considerable background and preparation.
"You think it's tough to look at a woman with a pony's penis in her mouth, Homer?" Larch asked him the next day,
when he was not under the influence of ether.
"You ought to look at something that's harder to understand than that."
"Here," Larch said, handing Homer the well-worn copy of Gray's Anatomy. "Look at this. Look at it 3 or 4 times a day and every night. Forget pony penises and learn this."
"Here in St. Clouds," wrote Dr. Wilbur Larch, "I have had little use for my Gray's Anatomy, but in France, in World War I, I used it every day. It was the only road map I had over there."
Larch also gave Homer his personal handbook of obstetrical procedure, his notebooks from medical school and from his internships. He began with the chemistry lectures and the standard textbook. He set aside a corner of the dispensary for a few easy experiments in bacteriology, although the sight of petri dishes caused Larch flashes of no uncertain pain. He was not fond of the world there was to be seen under the microscope. Larch was also not fond of Melanie. Specifically, he was not fond of her apparent hold on Homer Wells. Larch assumed that they slept together. He assumed that Melanie had initiated him, which was true, and now forced him to continue, which was not the case. In time, they would sleep together, albeit routinely, and that hold that Dr. Larch imagined Melanie had on Homer was balanced by a hold Homer had on Melanie, Homer's promise to her, which Larch couldn't see. He saw Melanie as Mrs. Grogan's responsibility, and he was unaware how his responsibility for Homer Wells might cloud his other responsibilities. He sent Homer to the river to catch a frog. Then he made Homer dissect it, although not everything in the frog could be properly accounted for in Gray's Anatomy. It was Homer's first visit to the river since he had fled from Melanie's destruction of the so-called Sawyer's Lodge, and Homer was impressed to see that truly half the building was gone. Homer was also impressed with the first live birth he was asked to observe.
not so much with any special skill that seemed to be required of Dr. Larch, and not with the formal, efficient procedures carried out by Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna. What impressed Homer was the process that was already so much underway before Dr. Larch's procedure began. What impressed Homer was how much had happened to the woman and her child that was, internally, just their natural progress. The actual rhythm of the labor, you could set a watch to it, the power of the woman's pushing muscles, the urgency of the child to be born. The most unnatural thing about it, to Homer Wells, was how clearly hostile the child found the environment in which it first exercised its lungs, how clearly unfriendly, though not unexciting, the child's new world was to the child, whose first choice, had it been given a choice, might have been to remain where it was. Not a bad reaction, Melanie might have observed, had she been there. However much Homer enjoyed having sex with Melanie, he was troubled that the act was more arbitrary than birth. When Homer went to read Jane Eyre to the girls' division, Melanie seemed subdued to him, not defeated or even resigned. Something in her had been tired out. Something about her look was worn down. She had been wrong, after all, about the existence of her history in Dr. Larch's hands. And being wrong about important things is exhausting. She had been humiliated, too. First by the incredible shrinking penis of little Homer Wells, and second by how quickly Homer appeared to take sex with her for granted. And, Homer thought, she must be physically tired. After all, she had single-handedly obliterated a sizable chunk of the man-made history of St. Cloud's. She had pushed half a building into the flow of time. She has a right to look worn out, thought Homer Wells. Something in the way he read Jane Eyre struck Homer as different, too, as if this or any story were newly informed by the recent experiences in his life. A woman with a pony's penis in her mouth, his first sexual failure, his first routine sex, Grey's Anatomy, and a live birth. He read with more appreciation of Jane's anxiety, which had struck him earlier as tedious. Jane has a right to be anxious, he thought. It was unfortunate timing, after what he and Melanie had been through together, that he encountered that passage in the middle of Chapter 10, where Jane imagines how it might be to leave her orphanage, where she realizes that the real world is wide, and that her own existence is not enough. Did Homer only imagine there was a new reverence in the girls' division when he read this section? That Melanie especially seemed poised above the sentences, as if she were hearing them for the first time. And then he hit this line. I tired of the routine of 8 years in one afternoon. His mouth went dry when he read it. He needed to swallow, which gave the line more emphasis than he wanted to give it. When he tried to begin again, Melanie stopped him. What was that? Read that again, sunshine. I tired of the routine of 8 years in one afternoon, Homer Wells read aloud. I know just how she feels, Melanie said bitterly but quietly. It hurts me to hear you say that, Melanie, Mrs. Grogan began softly. I know just how she feels, Melanie repeated. And so do you, sunshine, she added. Little Jane should try 15 or 16 or 17 years, Melanie announced loudly. She should try it and see if she doesn't tire of that routine. You'll only hurt yourself, dear, if you keep on like that, Mrs. Grogan said. And indeed this seemed true. Melanie was crying. She was such a big girl, to put her head in Mrs. Grogan's lap and allow her to stroke her hair. But she just went on crying quietly. Mrs. Grogan could not remember when she'd last held Melanie's head in her lap. Homer caught the look from Mrs. Grogan that he should leave. It was not the end of the chapter, not even the end of the scene, or even of a paragraph. There was more to read. The next line began, I desired liberty. But it would have been cruel to continue. Jane Eyre had already made her point. Homer and Melanie had already had several such afternoons, those days that tire you out about your whole life. This night the air between the girls' and boys' division seemed odorless and void of history. It was simply dark outside. When he went back to the boys' division, Nurse Angela told him that John Wilbur was gone.
adopted. A nice family, Nurse Angela told Homer happily. The father of the family used to be a bedwetter. They're going to be very sympathetic. As was Dr. Larch's habit, when someone was adopted, his routine benediction to the boys in the darkness was altered slightly. Before he addressed them as princes of Maine, as kings of New England, he made an oddly formal announcement. Let us be happy for John Wilbur, Wilbur Larch said. He has found a family. Good night, John, Dr. Larch said, and the boys murmured after him. Good night, John. Good night, John Wilbur. And Dr. Larch would pause respectfully before saying the usual. Good night, you princes of Maine, you kings of New England. Homer Wells looked at a little of Gray's Anatomy in the candlelight allowed him before he tried to go to sleep. It was not just John Wilbur's peeing that was missing from the night. Something else was gone. It took Homer a while to detect what was absent. It was the silence that finally informed him. Fuzzy Stone and his noisy apparatus had been taken to the hospital. Apparently the breathing contraption and Fuzzy required more careful monitoring, and Dr. Larch had moved the whole business into the private room next to surgery, where Nurse Edna or Nurse Angela could keep a closer eye on Fuzzy. It was not until Homer Wells had some experience with dilatation and curettage that he would know what Fuzzy Stone resembled. He looked like an embryo. Fuzzy Stone looked like a walking, talking fetus. That was what was peculiar about the way you could almost see through Fuzzy's skin and his slightly caved-in shape. That was what made him appear so especially vulnerable. He looked as if he were not yet alive, but still in some stage of development that should properly be carried on inside the womb. Dr. Larch told Homer that Fuzzy had been born prematurely, that Fuzzy's lungs had never adequately developed. Homer would not have a picture of what this meant until he confronted the few recognizable parts of his first look at the standard procedure for removing the products of conception. "Are you listening, Homer?" Wilbur Larch asked when the procedure was over. "Yes," Homer Wells said. "I'm not saying it's right, you understand. I'm saying it's her choice. It's a woman's choice. She's got a right to have a choice, you understand?" Larch asked. "Right," said Homer Wells. When he couldn't sleep, he thought about Fuzzy Stone. When Homer went down to the private room next to surgery, he couldn't hear the breathing apparatus. He stood very still and listened. He could always track Fuzzy down by his sound, lungs, water wheel, and fan. But the silence Homer Wells listened to made a more startling noise to him than the sound of that snake hitting the roof while his finger was in Melanie's mouth. Poor Melanie, he thought. She now listened to Jane Eyre as if it were her life story being told to her, and the only thing she ever said to Homer Wells was to remind him of his promise. "You won't leave here before I do, remember? You promised." "Where is he?" Homer asked Dr. Larch. "Where's Fuzzy?" Dr. Larch was at the typewriter in Nurse Angela's office, where he was, very late, almost every night. "I was thinking of a way to tell you," Larch said. "You said I was your apprentice, right?" Homer asked him. "If that's what I am, I should be told. If you're teaching me, you can't leave anything out, right?" "That's right, Homer," Dr. Larch agreed. How the boy had changed. How does one mark the passage of time in an orphanage? Why hadn't Larch noticed that Homer Wells needed a shave? Why hadn't Larch taught him to do that? "I am responsible for everything, if I am going to be responsible at all," Larch reminded himself. "Fuzzy's lungs weren't strong enough, Homer," Dr. Larch said. "They never developed properly. He was susceptible to every respiratory infection that I ever saw." Homer Wells let it pass. He regretted that Fuzzy had seen the photograph. Homer was growing up. He was starting the process of holding himself responsible for things. That photograph had upset Fuzzy Stone. There was nothing Homer or even Dr. Larch could have done for Fuzzy's lungs. But the photograph hadn't been necessary. "What are you going to tell the little ones?" Homer asked Dr. Larch. Wilbur Larch looked at Homer.
God, how he loved what he saw. Proud as a father, he had trouble speaking. His affection for Homer Wells had virtually etherized him. "What do you think I should say, Homer?" Dr. Larch asked. It was Homer's first decision as an adult. He thought about it very carefully. In 1930-something, he was almost 16. He was beginning the process of learning how to be a doctor at a time when most boys his age were learning how to drive a car. Homer had not yet learned how to drive a car. Wilbur Larch had never learned how to drive a car. "I think," said Homer Wells, "that you should tell the little ones what you usually tell them. You should tell them that Fuzzy has been adopted." Wilbur Larch watched Homer carefully. In A Brief History of St. Clouds, he would write, "How I resent fatherhood, the feelings it gives one. They completely ruin one's objectivity. They wreck one's sense of fair play. I worry that I have caused Homer Wells to skip his childhood. I worry that he has absolutely skipped being a child. But many orphans find it easier to skip childhood altogether than to indulge themselves as children when they are orphans. If I helped Homer Wells to skip his childhood, did I help him skip a bad thing? Damn the confusion of feeling like a father. Loving someone as a parent can produce a cloud that conceals from one's vision what correct behavior is." When he wrote that line, Wilbur Larch saw the cloud created in the photographer's studio, the cloud that so falsely edged the photograph of Mrs. Eames's daughter with the pony. He launched off into a paragraph on clouds, the terrible weather in inland Maine, the clouds of St. Clouds, and so forth. When Homer Wells suggested to Dr. Larch that he tell the little ones that Fuzzy Stone had been adopted, Larch knew that Homer was right. There were no clouds around that decision. The next night, Wilbur Larch followed the advice of his young apprentice. Perhaps because he was lying, he forgot the proper routine. Instead of beginning with the announcement about Fuzzy Stone, he gave the usual benediction. He got the whole business out of order. "Good night, you princes of Maine, you kings of New England," Dr. Larch addressed them in the darkness. Then he remembered what he was supposed to say. "Oh," he said aloud, in a startled voice that caused one of the little orphans to leap in his bed in fright. "What's wrong?" cried Snowy Meadows, who was always throwing up. He did not throw up only when confronted with the image of a woman with what he thought was a pony's intestines in her mouth. "Nothing's wrong," Dr. Larch said heartily. But the whole room of boys was charged with anxiety. Into this jumpy atmosphere, Larch tried to say the usual about the unusual. "Let us be happy for Fuzzy Stone," Dr. Larch said. Homer Wells knew what was meant when it was said that you could hear a pin drop. "Fuzzy Stone has found a family," Dr. Larch said. "Good night, Fuzzy." "Good night, Fuzzy," someone said. But Homer Wells heard a pause in the air. It had all been done out of order, and not everyone was completely convinced. "Good night, Fuzzy," Homer Wells said with authority, and a few of the little voices followed him. "Good night, Fuzzy. Good night, Fuzzy Stone." Homer Wells also knew what was meant when it was said that silence can be deafening. After Dr. Larch had left them, little Snowy Meadows was the first to speak. "Homer," Snowy said. "Right here," said Homer Wells in the darkness. "How could anyone adopt Fuzzy Stone, Homer?" Snowy Meadows asked. "Who could do it?" said little Wilbur Walsh. "Someone with a better machine," said Homer Wells. "Someone who had a better breathing machine than the one Dr. Larch built for Fuzzy. It's a family that knows all about breathing machines. It's the family business," he said, "breathing machines." "Lucky Fuzzy," someone said in a wondering voice. Homer knew he had convinced them when Snowy Meadows said, "Good night, Fuzzy." Homer Wells, not yet 16, an apprentice surgeon, a veteran insomniac, walked down to the river that had carried away so many pieces of the history of St. Clouds. The loudness of the river was a comfort to Homer, more comforting than the silence in the sleeping room that night. He stood on the river bank where the porch to the Sawyer's Lodge had been, where he'd seen the hawk come from the sky more quickly than the snake could swim to shore, and the snake had been very fast. If Wilbur Larch had seen Homer there, he would have worried that the boy was saying goodbye to his own childhood too soon. But Dr. Larch had ether to help him sleep, and Homer Wells had no cure for his insomnia. "Good night, Fuzzy," Homer said over the river. The Maine woods typically let the remark pass, but Homer insisted that he be heard. "Good night, Fuzzy," he cried as loud as he could, and then louder. "Good night, Fuzzy!" He yelled it and yelled it, the grown-up boy whose crying had once been a legend upriver in Three Mile Falls. "Good night, Fuzzy Stone!" Chapter 4. Young Dr. Wells. "In other parts of the world," wrote Wilbur Larch, "there is what the world calls society. Here in St. Clouds, we have no society. There are not the choices, the better-than or worse-than comparisons that are nearly constant in any society. It is less complicated here, because the choices and comparisons are either obvious or non-existent. But having so few options is what makes an orphan so desperate to encounter society, any society. The more complex with intrigue, the more gossip-ridden, the better. Given the chance, an orphan throws himself into society, the way an otter takes to the water." What Wilbur Larch was thinking of regarding options was that Homer Wells had no choice concerning either his apprenticeship or Melanie. He and Melanie were doomed to become a kind of couple because there was no one else for them to couple with. In society, it would have mattered if they were suited for each other. That they were not suited for each other didn't matter in St. Cloud's. And since Homer had exhausted the resources of the dismal tutors employed at St. Cloud's, what else was there for him to learn if he didn't learn surgery? Specifically, obstetrical procedure. And what was far simpler for Dr. Larch to teach him? Dilatation and curettage. Homer Wells kept his notes in one of Dr. Larch's old medical school notebooks. Larch had been a cramped, sparse note-taker. There was plenty of room. In Larch's opinion, there was no need for Homer to have a notebook of his own. Wilbur Larch had only to look around him to see what paper cost. The trees were gone. They had been replaced by orphans, all for paper. Under the heading D and C, Homer wrote, "The woman is most secure in stirrups." In Dr. Larch's procedure, she was also shaved. "The vaginal," capitalized, "area is prepared with an antiseptic solution," capitalized, wrote Homer Wells. He did a lot of capitalizing. It was related to his habit of repeating the ends of sentences or key words. "The uterus is examined to estimate its size. One hand is placed on the abdominal wall. Two or three fingers of the other hand are in the vagina. A vaginal speculum, which looks like a duck's bill, is inserted in the vagina, through which the cervix is visible. The cervix," he wrote parenthetically as if to remind himself, "is the neck-like part of the lower constricted end of the uterus. The hole in the middle of the cervix is the entrance of the uterus. It is like a cherry lifesaver. In pregnancy, the cervix is swollen and shiny. With a series of metal dilators, the cervix is dilated to admit entrance of the ovum forceps. These are tongs with which the doctor grabs at what's inside the uterus. He pulls what he can out." What this was, what Homer meant, was blood and slime. "The products of conception," he called it. "With a curette," noted Homer, "the wall of the uterus is scraped clean. One knows when it's clean when one hears a gritty sound." And that's all that was entered in the notebook concerning dilatation and the process of curetting. As a footnote to this procedure, Homer added only this. "The womb," one reads about in literature, "is that portion of the genital tract in which the fertilized ovum implants itself. A page number was jotted in the margin of this notebook entry, the page in Gray's Anatomy that begins the section, The Female Organs of Generation, where the most useful illustrations and descriptions can be found. By 1940-something, Homer Wells, not yet 20, had been a midwife to countless births and the surgical apprentice to about a quarter as many abortions. He had delivered many children himself, with Dr. Larch always present. But Larch had not allowed Homer to perform an abortion. It was understood by both Larch and Homer that Homer was completely able to perform one, but Larch believed that Homer should complete medical school, a real medical school, and serve an internship in another hospital before he undertook the operation. It was not that the operation was complicated. It was Larch's opinion that Homer's choice should be involved. What Larch meant was that Homer should know something of society before he made the decision, by himself, whether to perform abortions or not. What Dr. Larch was looking for was someone to sponsor Homer Wells. Larch wanted someone to send the boy to college, not only in order for Homer to qualify for admission to medical school, but also in order to expose Homer to the world outside St. Cloud's. How to advertise for such a sponsor was a puzzle to Wilbur Larch. Should he ask his colleague and correspondent at the New England Home for Little Wanderers if he could make use of their large mailing list? Accomplished midwife and qualified abortionist seeks sponsor for college years, plus medical school expenses. Where was the society where Homer Wells could fit in? Wondered Wilbur Larch. Mainly, Larch knew he had to get his apprentice away from Melanie. The two of them together, how they depressed Larch. They struck the doctor as a tired and loveless married couple. What sexual tensions Melanie had managed to conduct between them in the earlier years of their angry courtship seemed absent now. If they still practiced a sexual exchange, they practiced infrequently and without enthusiasm. Over lunch, they sat together without speaking, in plain view of the girls' or of the boys' divisions. Together they examined the well-worn copy of Gray's Anatomy, as if it were the intricate map they had to follow if they ever were to find their way out of St. Cloud's. Melanie didn't even run away anymore. It appeared to Dr. Larch that some wordless, joyless pact bound Homer and Melanie together. Their sullenness toward each other reminded Dr. Larch of Mrs. Eames's daughter, who would spend eternity with a pony's penis in her mouth. Melanie and Homer never fought. They never argued. Melanie seemed to have given up raising her voice. If there was still anything sexual between them, Larch knew that it happened randomly and only out of the keenest boredom. Larch even got Melanie a job as live-in help for a well-to-do old woman in Three Mile Falls. It may have been that the woman was a cranky invalid who would have complained about anyone. She certainly complained about Melanie. She said Melanie was insensitive, that she was never forthcoming with conversation, and that in regard to such physical attentions as helping her in and out of her bath, the girl was unbelievably rough. Dr. Larch could believe it, and Melanie herself complained. She said she preferred to live at St. Cloud's. If she had to have a job, she wanted one she could go to and then leave. "I want to come home at night," she told Mrs. Grogan and Dr. Larch. "Home?" Larch thought. There was another job in town, but it required that Melanie know how to drive. Although Dr. Larch even found a local boy to teach Melanie, her driving thoroughly frightened the young man, and she needed to take the driver's examination for her license 3 times in order to pass it once. She then lost the job, delivering parts and tools for a building contractor. She was unable to account for more than 200 miles that had accumulated in 1 week on the delivery van's odometer. "I just drove to places because I was bored," she told Dr. Larch, shrugging. "And there was a guy I was seeing for a couple of days." Larch fretted that Melanie, who was almost 20, was now unemployable and unadoptable. She had grown dependent on her proximity to Homer Wells, although whole days passed when there didn't appear to be a word between them. In fact, no intercourse beyond mere presence was observable for weeks in succession, if Melanie's presence could ever be called mere. Because of how much Melanie depressed Dr. Larch, Dr. Larch assumed that her presence was depressing to Homer Wells. Wilbur Larch loved Homer Wells. He had never loved anyone as he loved that boy, and he could not imagine enduring a life at St. Cloud's without him. But the doctor knew that Homer Wells had to have an authentic encounter with society if the boy was going to have a chosen life at all. What Larch dreamed of was that Homer would venture out in the world and then choose to come back to St. Cloud's. But who would choose such a thing, Larch wondered. Maine had many towns. There wasn't one as charmless as St. Cloud's. Larch lay down in the dispensary and sniffed a little ether. He recalled Portland Safe Harbor. His mind ticked off the towns, either east or inland from Portland, and his lips tried the towns with the good Maine names. Inhale. Exhale. Wilbur Larch could almost taste those towns, their vapory names. There was Kennebunk and Kennebunkport. There was Vassalboro and Nobleboro and Waldoboro. There was Wiscasset and West Bath and Damariscotta and Friendship, Penobscot Bay and Sagadahoc Bay, Yarmouth and Camden, Rockport and Arundel, Rumford and Biddeford and Livermore Falls. East of Cape Kenneth, the tourist trap, lies Heart's Haven. Inland from the small, pretty harbor town that's called a haven, squats the town of Heart's Rock. The rock in Heart's Rock is named for the uninhabited rock island that appears to float like a dead whale in the otherwise perfect harbor of Heart's Haven. It is an eyesore island, unloved by the people of Heart's Haven. Perhaps they were moved to name the eyesore town of Heart's Rock after their bird-beshitted and fish-belly-white rock. Nearly covered at high tide and lying fairly flat in the water, it lists slightly, hence its name, Dead Whale Rock. There is no actual rock in Heart's Rock, which is not a town deserving to be looked down upon. It is only 5 miles inland, and from some of its hills the ocean is visible. In most of the town, the sea breeze is refreshingly felt. But compared to Heart's Haven, every other town is a mongrel. When condemning Heart's Rock, the people of Heart's Haven do not mention the simple quaintness of the town's only stores, Sanborn's General Store and Titus Hardware and Plumbing. The people of Heart's Haven are more likely to mention Drinkwater Lake and the summer cottages on its murky shores. A not very fresh freshwater lake, more of a pond, because by mid-July the bottom is cloudy and rank with algae. Drinkwater Lake is Heart's Rock's only offering to summer people. People who summer on Drinkwater Lake have not traveled far. They may live elsewhere in Heart's Rock, or even more rustically in Kenneth Corners. The summer camps and cottages that dot the lakeshore are also used during the hunting season weekends in the fall. The cottages and camps have names of a striving wishfulness, Echo's End and Buck's Last Stand. This one is decked with antlers. There is one called Endless Weekend with a floating dock, one called We Three, W-E-E, suggesting inhabitants of an almost unbearable cuteness, and a frank sort of place called Sherman's Hole in the Ground, which is an accurate description. In 1940-something, Drinkwater Lake was already cluttered, and by 1950-something, it would become intolerably busy with powerboats and water skis, propellers fouled and oars festooned with slime-green algae stirred up from the bottom. The lake is too woodsy to let the wind through. Sailboats always die on the dead calm surface, which is perfect for hatching mosquitoes, and over the years the accumulated children's urine and gasoline would give the lake an unwell, glossy sheen. There are wonderfully remote lakes in Maine, but Drinkwater Lake was never one of them. The occasional bewildered canoeist looking for the wilderness would not find it there. The wild-hearted departed Winkles would not have favored the place. You would not willingly drink the water of Drinkwater Lake, and there are many tiresome jokes on that subject, all conceived in Heart's Haven, where the habit of judging Heart's Rock by its single sorry body of water is long-standing. When Homer Wells would first see Drinkwater Lake, he would imagine that if there were ever a summer camp for the luckless orphans of St. Cloud's, it would be situated in the bog that separates Echo's End from Sherman's Hole in the Ground. Not all of Hart's Rock was so ugly. It was a town of stay-put people on fairly open, neatly farmed land. It was dairy cow country and fruit tree country,